This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get on to the episode.
Welcome to the Counter Narrative Podcast, a show designed to change the way we talk and think about education. By sharing stories of successes and triumphs, we aim to challenge the dominant narrative that often negatively portrays our disenfranchised populations. I'm your host, Charles Williams, an urban educator for more than 15 years, a current school principal in Chicago, an educational consultant, an equity advocate, and the co-host of Inside the Principal's Office. Let's get started. Hello and welcome back to the Counter Narrative Podcast. As always, thank you so much for returning and checking out yet another episode. It must mean that we are doing something right if you are coming back. And if this is your first time, hopefully you will be returning. And I have an amazing guest on today. I think that will ensure that you definitely do. We were joking earlier that it feels like it has been years since we have shared the same space, but I think it may have only been about 2 years or so. A phenomenal educator who I've learned has shifted out of the classroom space, is pursuing her passions doing consulting work. So I'm sure we are going to hear a little more about that. But tonight on the show, I have Natalie Vardabasso. Natalie, yeah. You know, normally I ask before, and I want to make sure, did I say that correctly?
Yeah, typically people freak out about my last name because it's actually quite phonetically correct, but it's long. And right about halfway through, like, brains shut down. But you nailed it. And when in doubt, for yourself or your listeners, a good way to remember my name is that if you flip the B and the D, it becomes Vardabasso.
Oh, so, there you go.
You'll never forget.
Yeah. Natalie the Bat. I know. I was like, I was joking on a previous episode, like, look, we can't start cursing. But since the guest already did, I was like, hey, then I guess we've opened that door for that episode.
I guess I should have asked about that too.
Yeah, you're fine. So how are you? How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm good. I was just telling you before we recorded, it's a gray, rainy week here in Calgary, Alberta, which I'm actually welcoming. I'm a bit of a fall person. I love like sweaters, tea, being cozy. So I'm enjoying this transition and also the time at home because I have been on the road so much in August and September. So I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yeah, I know the idea of traveling. It's been a busy summer. I have six more conferences / sessions to close out this year.
Nice.
With some back-to-back. I say Chicago, but like I'm already here. But Whoa. Then heading out to Wichita and then literally flying from Wichita to Myrtle Beach. But those three different conferences all in a week. So definitely Whoa. Understand that travel. But when you love it, as we were talking earlier, it makes it a little easier.
Totally. And I do love travel, to be fair. I actually just visited Chicago for the first time 3 weeks ago. I love that city. I will definitely be coming back. I did the architecture boat cruise. I went to Wrigley Field. So yeah.
Natalie, you were in town and I didn't know.
I know. Like it's like a blink though. It's like I'm there for a day or two and then I'm gone. I tend to try to book like an extra day now whenever I'm on the road because I used to just do this like punishing, like fly in, do my thing, fly out. And now I'm like, spend the day, go see a Cubs game, you know?
Yeah. I mean, when you're here in Chicago, you have to see a Cubs game. Not to talk about that other team on the south side. We don't talk about them.
We don't talk about that. No. Yeah. I learned quickly.
So Natalie, for those listening, they're like, that's nice, guys. You're getting caught up. You should have done that before you press record. Tell us a little bit about who you are, what you're doing, you know, especially now, right, that you've made this transition. So tell us a little bit about you. Oh,
yeah. Well, my journey in education, I feel like the big thing to know about me that'll be kind of the caveat for everything I'll say next is I'm someone in the educational space who has a strong aversion to the status quo. And as a result, I ask a lot of uncomfortable questions. I embrace complexity and I'm continuously looking for ways to empower myself and others. So as a result, I've had a hard time just staying in one place or one role for too long because I get too curious. So I started as a classroom teacher in a special education environment. was in high school first and then moved into middle school. And from there, I shifted into instructional coaching, K through 12, like worked at every single classroom level, elbow to elbow with teachers. And through that transition, like the seed had already been planted from like my first year of teaching. But the more that I got out of my classroom and looked across the system, I was like, ooh, assessment and grading is the fire. If we want things to really change, it's this really uncomfortable bruise that nobody wants to talk about, but we need to talk about it. And so that shifted me into an assessment leadership position across a K to 12 context. Did that for about 4 years and saw a lot of results. We changed the narrative around assessment. We changed the grading system. And around that time is when you and I met through our Edu podcasting crew, our little group chat. Yeah. And that's when I started a podcast. And that was a big catalyst for a lot of things changing for me because it helped me to clarify my voice, but also to meet other people. And I think that in many ways was the catalyst for last May deciding that I was going to quit my job. It just felt like the next iteration. It was right on pace for where I would typically evolve. And we had made so much sustainable change happen. The leadership was so distributed. I kind of felt like I was just nesting at that point. So I launched into this consulting space and I also created my own online community and program called the Empowerment Ecosystem. And that's been all I've been doing for the past year.
Well, you know, I'm glad that you are doing this work. It is, as you mentioned, it is a much needed space. I think it is a space. Mm-hmm. I know even in the work that I'm doing here within Chicago Public Schools, it's like, that is a topic that not many mm-hmm. people want to address, right? You're saying mm-hmm. like grading and assessments, and they're just like, like, so let's talk about this other
response.
Thing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And it's like, yeah. No, like you said, right? Like we can't sit within that status quo because if things are not operating the way that they should be, right, not the mm-hmm. way that they were intended to, because that's why we had the status quo, then we do need to ask those difficult questions and sit in those uncomfortable spaces that result. But that's when change happens. So thank you so much for mm-hmm. doing that.
You're welcome.
So I'm guessing I have an idea of what we're going to be chatting about this evening, but let's launch into that. I know you kind of teased out the name of the podcast a little bit mm-hmm. in your opening there, but as we're thinking about pushing back and challenging the narrative, where do you want to go?
Oh gosh. I feel like the big narrative we have to challenge is around assessment and grading, because one of the deepest rooted things in this system is it's meant to be a system of teaching and enforcing, I should say, behavioral compliance. And where else is that more prominent than through our grading and assessment decisions? So that's the biggest narrative we have to change, is that that's why we assess and grade, which is to leverage behavioral compliance rather than these are naturally occurring aspects of the learning journey to gather evidence and to communicate at some point in a summative way, you know, what you've learned and where you need to go next. And that we instead need to be creating the conditions for learners to become assessors on their own behalf. That if we can rethink these things as tools we hand over to learners and create the conditions for them to do it successfully, then that's really, this changes everything in education. Then it's a space of agency rather than a space of compliance.
Well, but wait a minute, Natalie, if we teach our students to be agents for their own learning, what? Right, that they can assess themselves, they can figure out next steps, right, with us as guides and like, doesn't it strip us of our power?
Absolutely not. Then we actually get to live into the Latin roots of the word assessment, which is accedere, which means to sit beside, which is the dream. Don't we want to sit beside people in dialogue and learning and community? Isn't that the dream?
I mean, one would think, right?
And yeah.
So I love this idea of shifting it because, and you're right. Like, I think what bothers me the most is that if you sit down and you have these conversations with educators, or you go into spaces and you listen to the conversations that are happening, this is what's said, right? Mm-hmm. What we're saying right now isn't anything new.
No.
But yet mm-hmm. When we examine practices, mm-hmm. what we're doing is not mm-hmm. anywhere near aligned with what we're saying, what we mm-hmm. tout is the truth. And so I'm curious, as we're thinking about that, like, why do you think there's this big disconnect? Like, we know what we should be doing. We know which direction we should be moving. And yet, as a whole, right, education tends to hold on to this archaic kind of, like you mentioned, compliance-driven approach.
Mm-hmm. I think it comes down to a lot of lack of worthiness. And stay with me on this one. I feel like you can say to a room of educators, the reason we're doing this is to build agency, empowerment, ownership, every head will nod. Like, I always joke, that's the holy grail. If you say that's the why behind your ed tech initiative or your professional development topic, people will be like, yes, but then they don't want to change anything to get there. Like, they can't quite figure it out. And I think, because I've had some really tough conversations in the past couple of weeks, like, that are to the point where someone yelled at me, like, what makes you think you can come here and brainwash me? And I was like, whoa, what's going on here? And you sit with these people a bit longer, and so many of them were so successful in the system of compliance that was traditional education. And they went right back into that exact same system. And they've never once had the experience in their life of being agents of their own learning and creating something and really pursuing something. And they're so caught up with still trying to get a gold star from a perceived authority. And it's odd because I was in one school that was so progressive and innovative, and their leader was like a high school teacher that quit her job to start the school, to do things radically differently. We're aligned. She's telling me to push the envelope with them. And so I'm saying these things and she's nodding, saying, yes, do these things. And they're still like, I don't know. So even when the authority figure is like still there saying you can do these things, people don't do it. And I think it comes down deeply to a place of worthiness. I've gone my whole life in this paternalistic system where I was taught that everyone else has to make decisions on my behalf, that I am so scared to make decisions myself and to make a change because I don't think I'm worthy. I don't think I'm one of those kinds of people who can do that. And I'm sure, like, you're someone who's always been an innovator and a leader. You probably heard so many times in your work, oh, I could never do what you do. Like, just from stepping outside of the status quo and leading PD or speaking up at a meeting. And in my mind, I'm like, this is what we do. We are learners. Like, you ask questions, you speak up, you present, you create. Like, this is what we do. But it is an odd thing in the education space because it's like the only thing you can just keep going to for September for the rest of your life if you choose to, that some folks just haven't found that worthiness. And someone taught me, very wise, his name's Ken Williams, he wrote a book called Ruthless Equity. I was so frustrated. Oh, he's brilliant. I was so frustrated with teachers in my context constantly being like, oh, these kids are so low. They're so low. They just can't do it. And his saying is, when you call them low, you teach them low. And he said something beyond that that was brilliant. He said, when a teacher says these kids are low, they can't do it, you have to flip it in your mind to them saying, I believe I'm low and I can't do it. And I was like, ooh, that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like that's at the heart of it. It's just this lack of belief in themselves.
That's powerful. You know, it's, and I was just thinking, because literally I was in a space today, right, building these systems and structures. So I have this phenomenal instructional coach. So, you know, Fawn, if you're listening, super proud of the work that you're doing in the building. But, you know, I sat in one of the sessions today and I heard one of the teachers asking, because, you know, she's working on purposing with the teachers and kind of going through sequencing, right? Showing them how do we unpack standards? How are we intentional about, you know, moving through and building units that actually, you know, get students to where we need them to be and not just shooting and hoping for the best. And so one of the teachers said, well, wait a minute, like, but our students are, you know, are we really expected to get them to those higher level thinking on grade level for every unit? And we're just like, yeah, like what, what else are you doing? You know? And it's like, well, I'm not sure if they're able to. And when you were saying that about Ken, that's one of the thoughts that went through my mind right now of, is that a space of talking about the student, or is it the question of, I don't know if I possess the skills or the capacity to scaffold, to bridge, to get them to where they need to be, because regardless of how they start the unit, like, that is the destination. This is where we need everybody to be.
That's it.
Right. And if you give that escape to be like, well, they're low, I don't have to, or I'm never going to be able to, like, whew, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a powerful statement.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause what they're really saying in those moments, there's two things we have a really hard time saying in education. I don't know. And I'm really good at this. And unfortunately, to get all kids to where they need to go, we need a collaborative environment. And that collaboration is only going to thrive on the diversity of folks being able to say, I'm really good at this. I can support you. And others saying, I don't know. I need help. And so it's such a deep human thing that we're up against to try to transform the system, because the system's just people.
You're absolutely correct. And I'm curious. I want to know your thoughts on this. So oftentimes when I'm having this conversation around, you know, like the assessment piece, I think one of the other pieces that often comes to me is this idea of the structures that we have around assessments, right? We talk about their high stakes. And I think a lot of times we talk about that for the student, right? These high stakes standardized assessments, right? Which again, like, you know, I push back against it, not necessary. But I'm also, you know, point out that they're not just high stakes for the students, but because of the evaluation systems that we have in place, right? They're high stakes for teachers. And so when you know, for lack of better words, bastardize this process, right? You it's no longer this safe, authentic, natural learning process, but instead it becomes this thing that I now have to somehow manipulate and control, because my job, my bonus, my salary, my tenure, whatever it is, hangs in the balance. And I'm curious, have you come across any of that, or what are your thoughts about that?
Have I come across it? It is, yeah. Do you know who's really influencing my thinking right now on this topic? They just released a new book. It's wonderful. Dr. Bettina Love. She released a new book called Punished for Dreaming. And she points at the history of American education and how standardized testing played into that history. And now that I've read it, I can't unsee it, because I feel like all of the stuff we're talking about is rooted in some very historical systems of oppression, like all the paternalism that exists in the education space that makes people feel not worthy. It was historically women's work. I can't believe that those two things aren't connected. And Dr. Bettina Love also added a layer where she said, when the Nation at Risk document came out in 1983 through the Reagan administration, it was released and with just vitriolic language to create public uproar and fear that the American education system was failing and it was falling way behind its global peers. That document created the public discourse to be able to usher in the accountability movement and standardized testing and some good things too, because, you know, like higher standards through like the National College of the Teachers of Mathematics were ushered in. But that standardized testing movement was directly connected to the war on drugs. And her argument is it was designed with a deficit mindset to continue to create deficits, so that they can then have to try to fill these gaps and try to remediate and try to fix, and, you know, this whole achievement gap thing. But the tool was designed to create the deficit. Like, it's forever going to show that there's a deficit because of the poor design of the tool. And so I feel like with that in place, we're constantly in this like catch-up game of trying to chase this false sense of kids being on grade level because of a very structured like type of assessment that only works for some kids in some settings. And it's the trickle down effect, I think, is intentional. The more that I think about it, the more I read it. I used to think it was like, oh, you know, it's this frustrating thing we have to work around. And now I'm like, oof, if we really had agency and a voice as educators, we would be coming together to push back wholeheartedly and say, this is not right. And this is not even a valid large-scale assessment. Like, take the PISA, for instance, that years ago, it's an international assessment of student learning. They came up with automated ways to test competencies like critical and collaborative thinking. So there's way better tools out there. Why are we still using these archaic, multiple choice, like very culturally biased tests of knowledge and recall? Like, it's an interesting question to ask. And so I think I don't know if that fully answered your question, but it's just what's on my mind. I'm only about halfway through the book and I'm dying to talk to her on my podcast because I never saw it through the racialized lens. And now it feels like something I can't unsee.
Well, I'm going to put out the request now. Like when she gets on your show, can I just like tune in? I don't even need to speak. I'm just going to sit and listen because I don't know if I'd want to wait for the episode to drop. I'm like, all right, I got to go ahead and drop that book in my Amazon cart. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's
a fire of a read. Oh, it's so good. She did not hold back.
Nice, nice. Those are the best, for me anyway, those are the best ways, right? It's this idea, you know, recently as I've been doing my speaking, I've coined this idea of sugar-free speaking, right? Like, mm-hmm. let's stop trying to make everything so acceptable to everyone. And let's just have that honest conversation, mm-hmm. right? Like, because I think, as you pointed out earlier, this is one of the reasons why we've been stuck in these reform movements, because we're not really reforming anything. Mm-mm. You know, we keep repackaging. We keep kind of shining up old things and testing mm-hmm. them out. But you've mentioned something that now I'm curious and I want to dive into a little more to say, like, are we chasing that impossible dream, right? We've created this false narrative, this fake like reality to say, hey, mm-hmm. this is something that we're going to go and pursue, but you're never going to be able to obtain something that never existed to begin with.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's nothing research validated behind it. I should clarify. It's not like a false dream. It's if I were to take you, test you in one very narrow format to figure out your weaknesses and then group you based on those weaknesses and then hammer you with nothing but dry remedial garbage, you wouldn't learn. You wouldn't thrive.
Yeah, right.
Like, this is just, we have the research, we have the knowledge, yet this, I think it's a fear. It's a fear-based response that comes from people's unworthiness of, I don't know if I'm doing a good job. I want to make sure I'm doing a good job. I need the gold star. And you have enough information and data to say, and you know, that there's many testing companies that are rushing into this space, happy to tell schools how many kids are falling behind. And then they can sell them things, right? Like, it's right, all connected, right? Because then folks just are like, well, I need more of these tests to prove that it's the kid that's broken, that it's not me, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I'll create the assessment and then I'll create the books that you're using to teach them those things. Mm-hmm. Right. And then I'm not talking about any specific company, Pearson.
Here's a few. Yeah. Name. One of my colleagues said something brilliant to me lately. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm saying this everywhere I go. Cause I've been hearing more and more people rushing to get these norm referenced assessments implemented in their districts. And they've always rubbed me the wrong way, but I couldn't quite put my finger on why. And my colleague, who's, well, like, he does great work in assessment, he said, yeah, think about it this way. I could tell you exactly what your results are going to be for your norm referenced assessment. Half your kids will be below average. And I sat with that for a minute and I was like, oh shit. Sorry. But I was like, they're literally designed to put half your kids below the average because they're norming, so that right. they can say, oh, you need these remedial materials, you need these online programs. It kind of shattered me.
But, you know, you're bringing up a great point in the idea that it's like, maybe, right? And it's just, it's funny that we talk about added this idea that we really don't change, right? Like, the educational space. And yet at the same time, we're always changing. Mm-hmm. Right. But we're not really making any significant changes. And mm-hmm. maybe this is part of that process that we're so quick to grab onto the next thing that if we were to pause for a moment, like you just said, well, yeah, like, that is literally the definition. So mm-hmm. if you pause for a moment and said, well, wait a minute, it's just those like little light bulb aha moments. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that as people listen to this episode, they're like, wait a minute. It's like, mm-hmm. like, you know, the company U-Haul. One day mm-hmm. I was sitting there like at a red light and I saw the bill and I was like, oh, wait a minute. Because you care. Right?
Haul.
Like, it's those moments you're like, it's not just a word. It's not just a name, right? There's yeah. a meaning behind it.
Oh, yeah. No, I had that. This is an aside. I was in Kentucky and I drove by a KFC and I was like, oh my gosh, Kentucky Fried Chicken, because it's from Kentucky. Yeah, same thing. It was like yeah. so dumb, but so like, huh. I just said this word over and over and over and it's meaningless. But you bring up such an important point around space. I know in my own life, like, especially when you're your own boss, like, I really am the full agent of my entire life and work right now. When things have been the most unproductive and chaotic in what I'm trying to create is when I'm trying to be so overwhelmingly productive. Like I am so busy. I'm grinding all day, every day. I'm grinding on the weekend. And that's kind of what we're taught to do in the education system. Like there's this glorification of just working 24/7. And you're kind of socialized to do that because, you know, your colleague will come in and be like, oh, I was up till 2 a.m. last night. And you're like, oh, well, I was up till 3. You know, it's like everyone's kind of doing this in the staff room. Yeah. And my best big breakthroughs in my work this past year have been when I've just completely let go, like slow down to the point of just going, you know, I'm on the Polar Express. I am so cozy. I'm sitting here. It's snowy outside. They're serving me hot chocolate. I'm living my best life. And like just let go of everything. And then you're suddenly aware of all these opportunities because you're not so one-track mind focused on like, what's the next thing? What am I going to do? And I mean, I get that I'm privileged in the sense that I can make my own schedule and determine what my weeks look like. And I think there is still space for that mindset shift in education, for leaders and for teachers, for everyone just to slow down, and just take a breath and be in that relaxed space so that, you know, you can be open to the surprise of something appearing to you or occurring to you that maybe you never had let in before because you were just so hyper productive.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because, you know, my principal and I, like we're doing this PLC right now about burnout, and that's exactly what we're talking about. And today a group of students, I was leaving one meeting and I was heading back and they said, hey, AP, like, do you have a moment? Like, are you going off to another meeting? And I was thinking, no, like I do actually have a second. And they're like, you know, we want to get into the studio. Would you mind sitting with us while we record? I said, sure. And I'm sitting in there and I had my laptop open and I was just kind of like, I felt like, well, you should be doing something, not just sitting here and enjoying this. Like, and I was like, Charlie, you have nothing to be working on right now. Like, enjoy the moment, be present, be with these kids. And, you know, I just kind of closed it out and I was like, yeah, like let's have some fun. Right. But you're right. It's this busyness is this badge of honor, which I think could be a whole other conversation. So
it's like a name of a book.
There we go.
Business is the badge of honor. Yeah. Put that.
So, before I ask this next question, I just wanted to point out that you did this very interesting thing that when you literally were talking about being busy and you said 24/7, that was at the 24-minute mark in 7 seconds.
Stop.
Like on the dot. I was like, whoa.
Okay. See, those are those universe moments where it's like, okay, I see like, you.
And if you're not, if you don't believe me, listeners, like literally go back.
No, I'm looking at the time. It makes sense with what you're saying.
I was like, that's wild. I looked up. I was like, that was wild. But anyway.
Okay.
So, you know, we're having this conversation around, you know, assessment, because I know we went off on a little bit of a tangent here. So, you know, this idea around like the role that assessments should play within our space, right? And I know you dropped this fantastic text that could be a great resource for people kind of diving into this work. But maybe there are educators listening and saying, you know what, Natalie, you're right. Like, I believe in what we're saying. I believe that assessments in our spaces should serve this greater purpose, right? This idea of we talk about student voice and choice and agency. We say all of those things, but I'm not doing it. Right. So like, what are some things that somebody listening to this episode right now, like what are some suggestions, some ideas, maybe some starting points of how they can begin transforming, even if it's just within their own classroom, what assessment looks like in that space?
The number one shift that gets you off the hamster wheel and into a place where assessment can emerge and be a dialogue and responsive to a diversity of learners is to stop creating task-specific rubrics and create task-agnostic rubrics. And what I mean by that, it's going to sound so trite, so I'm going to explain it because people are like, oh, thanks, Natalie, is creating rubrics based on the learning rather than just the completion of the task. And this is something I kind of started to figure out on the fly, but then I've just really seen it come to fruition throughout all the work I've been doing. Because I would make rubrics for like the tsunami presentation project. That was like, you get 5 marks if you have a title. You get 10 marks if you have transitions, like just nothing about like the culture of Japan and how stoicism has emerged in that culture, which is really what the outcome was about. So task agnostic rubrics, the idea is you have to first ask yourself, if I were to list the five most essential learning goals in my course, if I were to name them, describe them, and people will often give you the throwaway things like, oh, well, they're going to be collaborators and critical thinking, and they're going to be creative. And you have to keep going a little bit, like, give me a one-liner. What does being creative look like in science? What does being creative look like in a theater class? Like, give me a sentence that describes that. Because what you have to do is start to create the conditions for students to become assessors on their own behalf, which starts with just naming what are your core learning goals. And this is where your standards, your outcomes, depending what country you're in, can be a really great resource to look at, because there's probably some language there you can work with. But if you're good with words, or if you can do a Google search of different countries, you can find other language. But it's such a good investment in time of saying, okay, what are my five things? Once you have them, and by the way, five is not like a research validated number. The research is pretty, like, it's between four and seven is sometimes a good list of, you know, kind of priorities and essentials. I just like five because it's memorable. But you have your five, and then you say, okay, what does success look like with this definition of creativity in theater class? You define that, and then that's your tool. That is now the beginning of your rubric. You could leave it just at that one list of these are my success criteria and use a single point rubric where the categories about what's strong and what needs strengthening are blank, and you just fill them out as you see evidence. Or you could take that criteria and say, okay, for each of these, what would be misconceptions or challenges or things that would arise as students attempt to meet it? And you could complete an analytic rubric. So you actually describe those different level gradations of quality. But once you have those, you've basically built your whole assessment system, because then all of the possibilities for the projects you could do, the ways you could integrate those skills, all the different types of evidence you could gather, and more importantly, you could share with the students and have them set goals within those and them gather evidence, are open to you. So it really is just a shift from realizing we're creating a hamster wheel of work when we make a rubric for absolutely everything we do in our class, instead of going, what's my most important learning goals in this space? And then just defining what success looks like. And then you can just refine and finesse that for the rest of your career.
So I'm going to have a full moment of like transparency and vulnerability here.
Okay.
In my school, where I'm at now, I'm going on my second year here in a mm-hmm. brand new space. And we've recently like become like an IB school. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those things where like we were struggling with, you know, going from the very, very, as I think you were mentioning, like task specific, like standards and these rubrics that we've been conditioned to create, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, is it pretty? Does it have these colors? Yeah. Is it 12 slides?
did you try hard?
Yeah. Like, you know, to this very open framework of IB to say, hey, look, when you're looking at world language, like these are the kind of concepts that you should be learning in world language, right? And we've noticed this very challenging, we've been challenged in the process of kind of moving in that direction. But as you were talking, I was like, all right, Charles, stay present, stay in the conversation. But immediately I'm like, oh, I think there's some pieces here. Like, I'm like, man, as soon as I jump off, I got to go look at a few things. But like, yeah, it just, what you were saying makes sense of this idea of, one, it makes life a little easier for everyone involved, right? Mm-hmm. And it allows us to focus more on the learning itself rather than what is happening, right? Even like, we've talked about as admin, as we're walking into the space, instead of asking kids, like, what are you doing? Right. Mm-hmm. Shifting that to simply, what are you learning?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Powerful, like, powerful shift.
Yeah. Like, it's getting away from just tasks, the learning task, to say, like, what is it that you're learning? Sure, the task is the vehicle, but like, more importantly, what are you learning and why is this important? Like, how does this fit in? What are you going to use it for? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, having that, and I like this idea. So I might have to pick your brain a little bit more, you know, afterwards as we go through this journey.
And to clarify here, I know maybe someone listening, the fear of this, because it reveals your instructional design. So to go to this place, people might go, but then why would kids have to do all the worksheets I need them to do every day? They're going to say, if it's not for marks, why would I have to do it? And it's like, yes,
yes.
This is
yes.
The beginning of the domino effect of start asking these questions, because the fact that we've handed all of our power to grades for so long as these quote unquote universal motivator is really a communication back to ourselves that my relationships with the kids are not motivating, that my design is not motivating, that the reasons that I convey to the students about why my course matters are not motivating. Like, when you can get people in that space of sitting in a room and the fear is big, I can always feel it. You know, the hard one, like English teachers, getting them to let go of multiple choice everything for reading comprehension to say, let's define what reading comprehension looks like. They're like, oh, eyes wide. And I'm like, you know this. Like, you have to just put it down somewhere and share it and say it. And it's hard as it is, I've sat with so many teams through this process. The 180, when a team gets through that storming phase of, I'm scared, I'm in like trauma response, I don't want people to know I don't know, to like, I'm curious and listening to one another and starting to Google things and be like, you'll never believe how Ireland describes this. Like, when it clicks and they start building it, it's like, there's no putting that back in the box. Then you've got people who are learning designers and not just teachers and curriculum coverers.
I love that. Like, are you ready to be a learning designer? Natalie, this was a powerful moment, and not just for the listeners. Like, I am, you know, I'll be honest, right? Again, just another, like, there have been many, many of these episodes where I've had a conversation with a person and we're just like, yeah, we're in the same space, right? We're bouncing ideas off, and it's really more for, you know, the curious listener. But I really feel like on this one, like, Charles, you are learning and growing in the space. So Natalie, thank you for that.
Thank you. That's very kind. I likewise always learn from you, Charles.
Well, Natalie, it's been phenomenal. And I know, like, I'm going to be booking some of your own time. But for those listening who are like, I also now want to get in touch with Natalie, or at least follow her, see some of the work that she's doing, how can they do that? How can they connect with you?
I am currently still on the artist formerly known as Twitter, a little begrudgingly, but I'm there. So I'm there at Natabasso. Play on my first name and last name. I am also recently shifted into the Instagram space, which I'm loving. And it's been a totally different creative challenge to think through the visual means. So if you're on there, same handle, Natabasso. But those are two good ways just to, like, Instagram, you're going to see more of like what I'm up to, my day-to-day foibles and travels and all the things, and educational content as well. I try to put something out daily. So that'd be the best place to get in touch with me. And I can also leave my email with you. I'm totally fine to give that out. And if folks want to explore what it looks like to collaborate, that'd be a great place to start. Just shoot me an email and we can set up a meeting.
All right. Wonderful. Well, I will definitely include that in the show notes. So if you are interested, feel free. And of course, you know, if you didn't catch those, Natalie's handles will also be there. But Natalie, I just want to say again, you know, at the beginning of this, I was mentioning, thank you for all the work that you do. You know, this is very, very important work. It's a must. It is a need. So thank you for that. But also, you know, thank you for coming onto the show. But I think tonight I'm going to add another piece there. Just thank you for allowing me to learn and grow with you, because I've definitely taken something away. So I just want to say across all of those, thank you, thank you, thank you. I think it was cutting me out right at the end there. And when I was doing my thinking,
it did cut you out there.
No.
But you're back.
We're all back. So I don't know what people are going to like hear in those like last 30 seconds. If it's just me, I'm just saying thank you for being on the show. I appreciate you.
I really appreciate you too. And thank you for inviting me on. It's nice to reconnect. And now that we're reconnected, I'm going to call you up next time I'm in Chicago. Get ready.
Please do. And hopefully it'll be appropriate weather to catch a Cubs game. If not, we have plenty of other sports. In fact, we are going to be taking a group of kids to the Bulls home opener in about 2 weeks. And we've got our new kid, Bedard, on the Blackhawks. Hey. So that should be interesting.
Yeah, you have quite the like suite of teams there in Chicago, I have to say.
Yeah, it's a pretty nice city to hang out in when you're looking for something to do.
Definitely. Well, I'll see you in Chicago.
See you soon. I want to thank you for listening to the Counter Narrative Podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to like, subscribe, and of course, share it with friends and family. I'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show, so please leave a comment or two as well. Now, I'm not sure what platform you're using, but the show can be found on Anchor, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, Spotify, and plenty of other platforms. If the show isn't on your preferred site, let me know, and I'll be sure to get it up and running. This podcast is also featured on schoolrubric.com, where you can find educational articles, videos, and interviews with educators from around the globe. Be sure to connect with me and other listeners by following the show on Twitter at the CN Podcast and joining the show's Facebook group. Take care.